it's a deference machine. You can defer to it and it will do the thing that you don't want to do. So the dirty work is not the tedious stuff that is safe and repetitive and otherwise even sometimes comforting and therapeutic to do. The tedious stuff is the stuff we actually have an aversion to doing, which is the hard stuff in life, which is making difficult decisions, ethical decision-making, especially someone who's a frontline border guard or a bank teller, and somebody shows up with some transgender mismatched ID. And do I have to check their pants? I mean, I don't want to do this. So it's easier if I can just say, well, the bank policy is, and this is why I can't, and this is why you can't, and that's the end of the story.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about trans rights.
Yeah, it's an important topic. So yeah, let's get stuck in.
All right. So we're happy to have Radhika joining us today. Radhika, do you want to say hello to folks and let them know who you are?
Hello to folks. I am Radhika, she, her pronouns. I am, I suppose, by occupation a software developer, so similar to the host of this show. I also work in the tech field, mostly specializing in two areas that have emerged from my career. One is geospatial information systems, and the other is identity and access management, particularly in web application development. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the two things overlap. I mention that because I think the reason I'm on this particular show is to talk about my activist activities, which I describe as reluctant activism.
Yes.
But they are shadows, in a sense, of the things I do for work. So one area that I spend a bit of time on is transportation safety and urban design. I'm one of these pesky people that rides a bicycle in my neighborhood, and I expect to not die in the process.
The audacity, yes.
That involves glamorous things like letter writing to local authorities and intervening in public consultations and public realm design. And it helps a lot to have a background in GIS, geospatial information systems.
Right.
The core question in GIS is this matter of how do you take a slice of reality distributed in space and model it in a way that it makes sense in a computer representation for processing, transformation, calculations, and so on. That's a useful analogy because the other parallel I have with my activism is with identity and access management, where I'm asking the core question, how do you take a person in reality and model that person so it makes sense in the world of a computer?
Yeah.
Some informational description of that person, which is basically a question of information architecture. And we often think about this because I work in identity and access management. We think about this in terms of digital computing, credentials, security, OAuth, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the history of this actually is much more fascinating. And the systems that we use day to day, passports, certificates, driver licenses, and so on, they are also artifacts of information architecture, but they started to happen before computers were even a thing. And we still live with them today, and they still influence how we do things on computers today, of all things. So the politics and technology of that are quite interesting. They especially apply in ways that affect marginalized communities, of which I belong to vaguely two kind of intersecting groups, transgender people and migrants of color. So you introduced this with saying trans rights is the thing to talk about. I want to expand on that a bit. In my particular background, it is more about issues concerning transgender migrants of color. That might seem pedantic to make that specific difference, but it does actually make a big difference in how legislation regulations are formulated, how policies are made. Maybe groups of people are treated differently. We have some shared experiences. We have some unique experiences. And so I spend a lot of time essentially working in that space, representing myself, really.
Right.
So when we think about the bicycling and transportation safety, accessibility in public space, there's a kind of physical self-defense I'm engaged in. where I'm motivated reluctantly to take part in it because I want to be safe.
Right.
And it's my version of think global and act local. But when it comes to dealings with identity documentation, the world of officialdom, how they describe humans and also how humans are possible to describe, who has control and authority over those descriptions, who gets to determine what gender marker you have on a passport and what kinds of names you're allowed to choose, those kinds of things. It's not physical self-defense, but it's one major area that affects trans people, which is a kind of epistemic self-defense.
Right.
So this phrase epistemic violence, feminist scholars have used for a few decades now, which describes roughly the phase of violence that follows quite often physical sexual violence, where the victim is brought into question about her credibility. Can she be believed? Did she consent or not properly? Was she asking for it? The gaslighting, everything that goes on, which essentially robs a person of the ability to know something. It's no longer conferred on them. So the basic epistemic violence with official documentation and the artifacts of government to describe a human, they bring into question who has the right to know, for instance, a person's gender identity. Can I determine it for myself? Is it self-determined? Or does a bureaucrat in the government determine this for me? Who gives them the authority? How do we contest this? Is it negotiated? What are the third parties involved? What do they have to say about it? How do the relying parties, the people that try to verify and authenticate identity documents correlated to a person, what role do they play? That complex field invites, you know, with all the troubles that it brings for trans people generally, but especially for over-documented or under-documented or undocumented migrants, many more complications. If you have a longer paper trail, you might have more places to update records. And if some of those records have different levels of authorization about what you're allowed to change, you might be more limited and restricted in ways that I'm experiencing in a country like New Zealand. But if you're also undocumented in a sense, you don't have documents like a birth certificate, or you don't have documents like a driver license or something, it might also be difficult to exist in society or to eventually get official paperwork that recognizes you as who you are. In the US, DACA recipients were forced to revert back to using their so-called birth names in order to receive benefits and privileges under that program, rather than using their preferred name or the cultural name or the custom name that they were given, whether they're transgender or not. Now, that affects migrants, but if you think of the transgender subpopulation within that group, it specifically affects them worse because they have to deal with being misgendered by or deadnamed by that forcible name change. So the epistemic self-defense I'm engaged in isn't really about changing the world and making it a better place. When I experience these things, I'm often finding myself on the end of a phone line with a government official or a private sector organization that has records about me, and I'm trying to exercise rights under privacy law to get them to correct information or to accept identification documents or to override some identification documents that I can't update, to respect in my country the common law right to change a name. This is also true in the US and the UK and Australia and Canada, but it's not so true in continental Europe. That's not so present, for example. But I still get to exercise that here, but that doesn't mean everybody respects it. There's a tendency, a general drift towards civil law that tries to make name changes officiated and formalized. So I end up doing this as a way to just advance my existence, and that becomes a kind of field of activism. But I just want to give a disclaimer. I know that you folks are especially sympathetic to the idea of collective action.
Right, yes.
And a lot of this self-defense I'm doing is very solitary.
Mm-hmm.
I do actually contribute a lot of other causes and other people's programs of activism in ways that I chip in and support. But when I'm talking about my activism in that I'm engaged with it, focus and trying to achieve objectives, and I feel responsible for it, that's this kind of work, basically.
Can I just like chip in a bit there? Because what happens is when people do things to other people, it creates a permission structure for that to happen. When people defend themselves against those things and succeed, that also creates a permission structure. So I don't think it's necessarily like just, you know, even though you're doing it for your own purposes, which is completely understandable, you are setting some precedents, which is probably very handy for a lot of people to kind of like flow in behind.
Yeah, speaking of common law, I mean, precedent is a very important aspect in common law, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can echo that sentiment. When I take part in this kind of activism, obviously the primary objective is I want to accomplish some outcome that will benefit me, but I'm also trying to do it in a way that I'm perhaps taking an educational role or an informative role or just a feedback role as a customer of an organization or something, and helping the organization or government department, whoever it might be, to ideally impose a policy change that will mean that the next person has an easier time dealing with the same circumstances, or even better, the next person comes along and they don't even realize there used to be an obstacle here.
Right, yes.
And there's no bronze plaque saying, you know, here was somebody who lobbied against this thing to be changed, and it's just invisible. And that would be the perfect outcome for those kinds of cases. And I have a success rate that is hovering around 5%. That's actually a reasonable success rate for this kind of exercise.
Very good, I would say, yeah.
So I'm happy enough with how that's working out as a strategy for the moment. But, you know, I would really like to take part in more collective action on these subjects. It would be great if we could organize people who are affected, transgender migrants of color who are affected in a country like this. But it's practically impossible, mostly due to scale. I don't know how familiar folks are with the demographics of New Zealand, but it's a small country by population with a sparse distribution on a relatively large landmass. So the idea that you select for a minority of the population who are migrants, and within them a minority within a minority who are transgender, and within them, particularly the people that come from the so-called global south countries where there are more restrictions on their identity, and then within that people who are of age, because of our immigration controls being biased against transgender migrants, we end up not allowing adult transgender people to migrate so often, so that our population of migrants of color who are transgender here skews very young, because children are the ones that enter unidentified as a trans person and then grow up to come out. So if we select for people of all of those factors, and then the people who are safe, stable, and secure in life to be able to take part in some activism where they're not afraid of retaliation by the government and all these other things. We don't get a fraction of 100 people, like 15 people can form a committee together. We get about 0.6 individuals.
Of which you are one.
Right. And there's a great risk of burnout and all these other things, because there's a single individual at any given time kind of working on some of these issues. So collective action on that front is not so easy. And then the allyship question comes in next, where people will say, well, why don't you find natural allies to help you out with this? And that's also systemically basically undermined. If I was to reach out to people, and I have, who are in migrant collectives, migrant workers collectives, and those kinds of things, they are groups of people who are also filtered by the immigration controls, who are selectively biased to being more conservative populations. And so even in the home countries, they would not be very friendly to trans people in the first place. Why would they be so over here? And if we look at the potential allies in the general mainstream LGBTQIA plus groups, there's where the interesting crux of this debate comes in. There's a fault line that runs through many societies that are post-colonial, which is the question of who's in the in-group and who's in the out-group of a nation state. And quite often that ends up being a racial division. So I'm citing Charles Mills, who is a Jamaican-born, I think, physicist turned philosopher, who wrote a book called The Racial Contract in the 90s. So if your listeners are going to tune out in the next 30 seconds, they'll have the most valuable recommendation at this point in the podcast. The Racial Contract is a book in the fashion of a previous book by, I think, Carol Pateman, who wrote a title called The Sexual Contract. And both of these books take a very similar angle, which is to critique the concept of the social contract.
Right.
And so this is a point of departure perhaps for us, because I do remember trivia from previous episodes of this podcast that I listened to in the backlog in preparation for coming on the show. I think both of you expressed some affinity at some point for the Enlightenment and its values and perhaps a social contract.
That's Ray.
Wow.
Throwing you under the bus, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, let's just be clear about, you know, there are certain aspects of the Enlightenment that I don't want to throw away, like reasonable, sure. You know, like rash, like the fact that we have science. I mean, you know, I think that's kind of interesting and valuable. But there are plenty of things about the Enlightenment that I don't like. So, yeah, please, you know, hit me up. But let's not throw me under the bus prematurely here.
Let's
hear the point first.
Yeah. But when you say the social contract, this is John Locke. Was he the original, or Hobbes, one of those two?
Hobbes and Leviathan, Locke with the individualism, Hume, Mill contributed to the idea.
Yeah,
Jean-Jacques Rousseau eventually, I think, kind of formalized this social contract concept, but it developed over decades. You see, it's an informal idea, but the basic construct of it is this presumption that this mythological story, it's a Garden of Eden story of humanity, that everybody started out as barbarians and savages to begin with, and then a select few elite blessed individuals came forward to form these mutually reciprocal bonds, and by virtue of their wisdom, they are enlightened. And they deserve all the benefits, privileges, and rights that come with that for the small sacrifice of being in a social bond with each other.
Yeah. That's definitely not what I meant. Okay. I'm definitely not defending that, okay?
No, sure.
To be clear.
Mills does a good job of actually tracing like the fully evidence-based history of how people develop this concept and lays out how this in-group, out-group concept arose conveniently at precisely the time of the Age of Discovery, the Doctrine of Discovery, colonization, settlement, where the easy one-to-one mapping is to say, well, we, the enlightened few on these sail ships going to the distant oceans and shores, are going to encounter, oh, look at that, it turns out they're barbarians and savages and they're uncivilized.
Right. We're on a mission to civilize this type of shite. Yeah.
Or indeed, just to be able to say, because they're not fully persons, in a place like Australia, we can have a doctrine of terra nullius. They don't count. They can't claim land. Mills also goes into this thing about looking at some of the biographies of these people. I think it's Mill and maybe Locke, I'm not sure which ones, themselves had property of enslaved people in the colonies, which showed that while they were writing these lofty, ambitious, and very high-minded prose about equal rights.
Jeffersonian, if you will.
Yes, exactly. They expressed basically the dichotomy of who counts and who doesn't as a person in their practice. So, you know, I'm summarizing in a nutshell this fantastic work that can't really be summarized. It's worth reading it if you're if you ever get the chance.
It'll be in the show notes for those who are interested.
So what this does,
myself among them.
Right. But this fault line that Mills identified doesn't disappear so fast, right? So what happens is, in the rise of nations, which is the process by which we developed all this official dumb of paperwork, this technology, this information architecture of paperwork that identifies people, models humans as information, is not old. It's only about, in the form that we recognize passports today, about 100 years old.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
First World War.
Okay.
That's when it really became systematized and widespread and mandatory to use. Prior to that, there's a world of slapshot, ad hoc regulations on potential travel. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, there really wasn't any documentation required for travel. You could just kind of free movement everywhere, conceptually. Nature had other ideas.
Sure.
Bears in the woods and dysentery on the Oregon Trail. But that friction that nature offered meant that nobody felt the need to regulate travel. When industrialization made it possible for people to more easily travel, suddenly the higher degree of contact people had with each other increases motivation. The first migrant panics arrived on the Austro-Hungarian border. Oh no, the Ottomans are coming, etc.
Right.
So there was this need to try to regulate travel and filter people's movement across space. And so borders were invented, which didn't exist really before, as besides vague concepts. And that was an attempt to try to codify what James C. Scott says is making citizens legible to the state. It's an attempt to codify who's in and who's out, who's in the in-group and who's out of the in-group, which maps again closely to the racial contract critique of the social contract. People who are in deserve rights and privileges. People who are out don't, but may be exploited, may be treated as beasts of burden, may constitute a reserve army of labor who are migrant working class people. And that hasn't disappeared. Like, we still have many vestiges, if I may be charitable, of that formulation still today, even in a place like New Zealand, which is seen as a progressive Scandinavian country of the South Pacific, nonetheless has this division about lesser, fewer rights and privileges granted to people who are of a migrant status, even if that migrant was to become a citizen of the country by naturalization. You are still a second-class citizen, and that's the category I find myself in, with respect specifically to certain rights that have to do with being transgender. So this intersectional experience of being a transgender migrant of color means that I'm finding myself on the wrong side of the fault line of the racial contract and not entitled to the same treatment that even the crumbs, the few crumbs of concessions that trans people in this country, of this country, have. I can't even access that, basically. So if I appeal to an advocacy organization or an activist group that is centered on the well-being, quote-unquote, of trans people, and this is the issue with the phrase trans rights. The implication is this is about trans people. But if we look at the definition of personhood that Mills has given us, some people don't count as people. Some people are more equal as people.
Right.
And this is actually a phrase in the law. In New Zealand, a specific law that has to do with amending birth certificates uses a phrase to include or exclude people. It says you must be, quote unquote, an eligible person. Now, they leave it beautifully ambiguous because they don't define what an ineligible person is. There's no such category. So that makes it, this is a little bit of wordplay, but it makes it open to interpretation whether a person is ineligible because they're a person and then not given their rights, which is inexplicable. Why would you be a person that's not given the rights? Or are you not eligible for personhood in the first place?
Wow. Yeah.
And that's the thesis that Mills proposes. So I find that if I was to reach out to some of these organizations, activist groups, and so on, they don't have an interest in crossing that virtual border. Borders are hard borders, lines in the sand or shorelines or whatever. But migrants are allowed to cross those territorial borders, enter the land, and still have a virtual border following them around, a bubble of exclusion that says you can't access this healthcare, you can't get that educational access, you can't get this kind of a job. That virtual border still follows you around and eventually says you can't be a trans person, right? If that becomes part of your life. And that's where I'm often having to work with out the assistance of natural allies.
Right.
That it would require surmounting this massive gap of ending racism first for them to be able to reach out.
Oh, that little thing. Yeah.
So that's just a way, by way of disclaimer, why it is I tend to work solo on these things. I'm not promoting the idea that people should work solo on things. I would promote collective action preferably.
Right.
And perhaps in this country with a bigger population, there might actually be enough people to self-represent as a group.
Right.
But my experience so far has been that that's not really possible to organize in a place like this. So it's a unique experience because I'm an outsider to this place. I admit that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have an outside perspective to New Zealand. And living in a small country with a small population, it's a culture shock for sure, considering I come from a big city in South India.
Right. Right. Yes. Well, thank you, Renika, for that kind of opening salvo. And I definitely take your point. Speaking of intersectionality, it was very interesting how you laid out how the intersections actually kind of narrow down the group of people affected, and how that, I think we've talked about this before on the show, the neoliberal idea of atomization, that using identity as a weapon to separate people actually makes it difficult for collective action. So I think you've illustrated that beautifully with that. Well, horribly, I'll say, but you did a beautiful job of illustrating the horrible situation that we have.
Yeah. One thing to add to that maybe is that the way it works is that everything is sort of contingent, you know, that every single group that you talk about is essentially part of this contingency. So you just happen to be at the end of all of the, well, maybe it's not all of them, but the end of quite a large number of these contingencies that ends up, like, you end up being, yeah, a kind of special case. But obviously, I'm pretty sure that you understand.
A 0.6th of a person, if you will, by your own.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's kind of like one drop in a weird way, but yeah. But yeah, so I think what's interesting, of course, is not to deny all of the other contingencies, because that's the difficult part about this stuff, is that you end up like narrowing it down, and then you end up saying, oh, well, because of those contingencies, all my allies get dropped. But actually the problem is the contingencies themselves. And I think that's really what we want to talk about, isn't it? It's the fact that this narrowing down of, or excluding of, certain people through certain traits or identities or aspects of their individualism. That's what's going on, is that somehow there is this normal thing, which is, again, contested. That's really the point. In fact, that's what we're contesting. And so, you know, maybe, I don't know if you want to really discuss that aspect, because that seems to be the most important thing, kind of like today. It's like, what is normal? Is anything normal? Can we be, does normality mean anything anymore? That's the moral panic that people are facing, I think, that there's always this, you know, oh my God, you're black. Oh my God, you're a woman. Oh my God, you know, you've got feelings. Oh my God.
Oh, you know, my God, you're pregnant. A black trans woman or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll get there in the end, you know, but you know, we're starting with the, you're a woman. We're starting with, you're black. So that's where you start, because that's already contingent. That's my point.
Yeah.
Those two groups are not normal, even though women dominate in terms of numbers.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you want to address anything of that. Does that resonate in any way to what you were saying?
Massively, because, okay, here's the thing. I don't have an original thought in my body.
Who amongst us?
You've already demonstrated the opposite of that, but okay.
I'm just going to cite Charles Mills again, because this is the rest of the book. So the previous book I mentioned was written by Carol Pateman called The Sexual Contract. It tried to critique the social contract from the perspective of gender. And Mills didn't just introduce the race dimension to the analysis. He actually made an encompassing framework that also tried to explain and incorporate that sexual contract concept. Where does gender fit into the question of relationship with racial discrimination? So this is heading towards the theory of intersectionality, but in a way that's very, I find, very lucid, that only a physicist turned philosopher could write about. So the way he describes it is people who are members, full members of the social contract, which is just a proxy for this racial contract concept, he would call them contractors. And people who are outside of that, maybe, you know, at the extreme, considered subhuman, untermensch, whatever you might call them. But actually, everybody exists on this spectrum of contingency, like Ray just said, which is what he calls subcontracting. So archetypal category that he introduces is, for purpose of analysis, white women who do not qualify, historically especially, as equal to men. They couldn't own property, couldn't vote, couldn't do all of these things at the same time. They were not beneficiaries of the social contract in the same way that the dominant group of the people who established the concept saw themselves as. But they were still given conditional privileges over and above the presumed savages and barbarians. And it's a negotiation, it's partial, and it's a dialogue all the time. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the good news is our relationships in this concept can change. Mm-hmm. It is possible to renegotiate the terms of the contract. And so that's how he introduces this concept. I don't have anything to add to it.
Well, I think the fact that there's a negotiation, a constant negotiation, is, and it's fluid. This is something that we, like, the basis of this show is that things are inevitable, that things can be contested, and that things are contested, and things continue to be contested. And this concept of a settlement is subject to intervention along the way. And I think this is an important thing that we kind of can always, you know, you find one thing that is, like you were talking about the DACA recipients, they were accidentally then, let's say the trans people in DACA were accidentally hurt more. But, you know, we can imagine the opposite situation where something becomes liberated or something, the contestation falls away, that then that will benefit more people. Accidentally again, you know, so it's kind of like all of these contestations are somewhat, they're a bit like a gyroscope, you know, a kaleidoscope, you know, as you turn things, the shapes aren't obvious how things will fall.
Speaking of this intersectional experience, there is a specific inversion of the presumption of innocence that gets applied to the outgroup members, whoever they are. So if you're an outgroup member because you're a migrant to a place, I use the word migrant as distinct from, let's say, expat, which is kind of this reserved category for people who are of a similar kinship group to the in-group already of a particular nation state. So if you're a migrant, the kind of person who is allowed to immigrate so you can drive an Uber, what you might face through the entire technological interaction that you have with the administrative state, all that documentation, all that paperwork, all of those restrictions that don't allow you to express your own identity at any point or to control it, is a presumption of fraud, deception, and subversion. Because you're an outsider, we are presuming from the point of your initial application that you are here to commit fraud, to deceive us, and to subvert our society, perhaps to be a spy or whatever the case may be. So you have to now, as part of the immigration hurdles to cross, you have to now disprove this charge. And you can, if you show how you could be a model citizen, how you're not going to be a burden on the healthcare system, how you don't need further education, or you're going to pay for it if you are going to participate. If you can demonstrate all these things, one of the things you want to demonstrate along the way is, oh, by the way, I'm cisgender and straight, and so I don't have a risk of HIV plus. I'm not going to demand healthcare in terms of medical interventions for transgender people and so on. So I'm a good migrant. I'm one of the good ones. Please let me in by exception. The vast majority of migrant applications don't get accepted. So you have to prove you're exceptional. But this also applies if you speak to trans people, whether they're migrants or not. They will all tell you that their experience in life is that they get treated with a presumption of fraud, deception, and subversion. If you're a transgender person, take the example of Kansas today. With the law change that requires you to have your driver's license with your birth assigned details, name and sex marker, there are cases where people, a trans man who's big, burly, bearded, and bald-headed, will not match that ID. It will not look like a Ms. Emily, something or the other. But then instead of saying, oh, well, this makes sense, you're transgender, so that's why this information has been arranged this way, the presumption is you are conducting identity theft. We will treat you as if you're a criminal, unless you can exceptionally prove somehow that this ID matches you, the person, or that you're deceptive as a trans person, because the presumption is someone who enters a sexual relationship as a trans person is trying to turn a potential partner gay. And so this gives rise to the gay panic defense, the trans panic defense that allows people to get away with murder sometimes. Or subversion, that you're here to subvert the norms of gender binaries and gender norms and roles. So you're a threat to society in that sense, but you can escape that. If you're a trans person, you can say, well, look, at least perhaps the model trans person, you can imagine the model trans person might be an ex-military service person, someone who has bled for the country, for king and country or constitution or whatever is applicable. If you can show alignment with the in-group and show that you're nationalistic enough for participation in that group, you're almost someone who would qualify, except for this one thing, can you please overlook that? I'm one of the good ones. Then you can get some of that contingent, conditional, subcontracting privilege. But here's the problem. If you're a transgender migrant of color, you can't escape either of these charges. You can't use the escape hatch of, oh, you know, at least I'm not gay or trans. And you can't say, well, at least I'm a good patriot. And so you get completely stuck in limbo, and there is no affordance to be able to escape this charge at all. And that presumption is a semantic, it's a constraint that applies in all of the design choices that apply in the technologies where we record identity. If you can make the right argument to escape the charge, then you'll have the right to update some detail, change a gender marker, update a photo, get a new piece of documentation, like a birth certificate. But if you can't escape that charge, then the presumption all these identity systems is we are here to minimize fraud. We want integrity and consistency in the database of identities that we maintain. So you cannot possibly update these things.
Yeah. And that, we are going to speak about AI, and that kind of is this idea of minimizing fraud. This has been a way that several countries, the Netherlands is one famous example, have deployed, you know, AI, whatever the hell that means, you know, some machine learning algorithm to detect fraud and kick the undeserving poor off the welfare rolls. But when you're talking about pattern matching, I am guessing, as usual, there is existing discrimination against trans people, against migrants, against people of color. As you've said, you know, you're at the intersection of those three points and potentially more points of marginalization. One thing that we've talked about is that technology or AI should be seen as an automation technology, but it's a technology that is really automating the harms being done by the status quo and making accelerating, basically. So I'm just wondering, I don't have a sharp point on this. I'm just kind of throwing that blob of words at you and seeing if that rings any bells in your mind.
I think it rings about 15,000 bells. you can cut that up.
Inside joke.
This is a term I'm experimenting with a little bit. What you've just said about how you automate the harms, it betrays a point that a lot of people who are boosters of this agglomeration of technologies that is labeled as AI promote it as, which is the, Dr. Rowe has said this reverse centaur metaphor.
Right.
It's a division of responsibility that takes place. But the way people express this on the booster side is to say, we'll automate the tedious work, but we'll leave the important stuff to the human.
Right.
As a promise. Right. But do my eyes deceive me? It's exactly the opposite. Not just because the reverse centaur and the economic benefits of it, but actually if I think about this behaviorally and how humans approach ethical dilemmas. If you pick out any middling philosophy undergraduate student and give them a series of trolley dilemmas.
Oh, God. I'm going to put that in the show notes, actually. There's a wonderful series of trolley dilemmas on the internet. But sorry, continue.
So if you present this to a bunch of people, a pattern will emerge, which is, yes, of course, people will fall on different sides of the fence with different impossible choices. But most decent people, at least, will probably at some point express a sentiment that I hope I'm never in a situation like this. I hope I never have to make this decision. I hope I can avoid being in a position where I'm the one at the switch for the trolley junction. Well, here's a machine that will take over for you.
Accountability sink. Yeah.
So it's a deference machine. You can defer to it, and it will do the thing that you don't want to do. So the dirty work is not the tedious stuff that is safe and repetitive and otherwise even sometimes comforting and therapeutic to do. The tedious stuff is the stuff we actually have an aversion to doing, which is the hard stuff in life, which is making difficult decisions, ethical decision making.
Absolutely. Anthony Moser made the point in episode 2, which will have aired by now, that of the Israeli target generation, right? This is computer says kill. I'm sorry, my hands are tied.
So what I can add to the discussion is, I'm sorry to take you back to the 19th century, but the rise, the deference machine that what AI is presumed to occupy now, the role in society that I can just say, computer says no, computer says do this, whatever it is.
Right.
And I don't have to think about it if I'm especially someone who's a frontline border guard or a bank teller and somebody shows up with some transgender mismatched ID. And do I have to check their pants? I mean, I don't want to do this. So it's easier if I can just say, well, the bank policy is, and this is why I can't, and this is why you can't, and that's the end of the story. Unless perhaps you can conform to your identity. So we make the identity prescriptive. It becomes a source of truth, not your existence is a source of truth that the identity reflects, but you have to fit the identity somehow. If you can do that, then I'll let you through or I'll get you access to your bank account or whatever it is. But I don't have to make an ethical decision. I can leave that to somebody else. The deference is actually convenient for me. And I actually suspect this is why there's a massive uptake of these technologies. The convenience of actually not having to think about hard stuff anymore, which is difficult if you're a human in a social environment. But that's not new.
Mm-hmm.
The previous generation, I think, of the deference machine was not the automated generation of these probabilistic structures that we call transformers and models. The previous generation of that was enterprise software, which was spaghetti code and complicated and sprawling code bases that could not be reasoned about, that were obfuscated, but in an artisanal, handcrafted way by guilds of practitioners whose job was to make things difficult to reason about.
Sure. Sometimes unintentionally.
Well, unintentionally on the part of the individual who's heroically trying to simplify the system, but somehow the emergent property of the system is that it is as obfuscated and is as unaccountable as some of these automated generated systems that we have. So the bank teller who's now relying in the 1990s and the 1980s on policy and rule system to determine whether this ID should be accepted of a trans person showing up at the counter doesn't need to wait for ChatGPT to come and say yes, no, maybe, but can just say, well, this Byzantine policy rule system of the bank rules engine has said, I can't accept your ID. Sorry, I'm not allowed to click next on the flowchart. And so now you're not allowed to have access to your bank account anymore. But that's not new either. The previous version of that electronic digitized system was a Kafkaesque bureaucracy of many bits of paper. And so the way people would defer to the machine was to say, I was just following orders.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And where does that leave us?
I mean, I guess the point is that there are ways to make people bend the rules if you can. There's some magic somewhere. And like you say, it's either some sort of close conformity to a particular expectation, or it's a little bit of money, or it's a little bit of give and take, you know, personal knowledge, maybe, you know, it's where you don't know somebody and somebody's operating on a seemingly automaton kind of regime. That's where things start to become quite tricky, because we always want to hack the system. We all, you know, we're kind of made like that, I think. We usually, like, depending where we are, we'll kind of know what the hack is. It's either smile or say, or be polite, or, you know, we just be quiet. And we can conform in a nice way, or we give someone some money, or we do them a favor, or whatever it is, you know. So there are usually these ways around these things, but it's becoming tougher. It's definitely becoming tougher, I think.
Mm.
The rules are becoming more strictly enforced at the edge. And that seems to be a difference these days.
Yeah. If we look at the opposite extreme of the spectrum, again, this takes us back in time, but if we go before the Kafkaesque bureaucracy, what was the way to defer to some external authority to make a decision for you on some ethical dilemma?
Religion.
Up in the sky. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so full circle, we're trying to make AI into a god now, so it will be believable and plausible as a replacement for the ethical authority.
Absolutely.
Beautifully done. You stuck the landing, Radhika. That's amazing.
But what we've seen is this increasing efficiency with each of these systems, right? I'm so glad we're having this conversation as I think three Clojure developers, because I can throw words at you that you will understand that when I talk to anybody else about this subject matter, they will need a lot more explanation ahead of time. So the way deference works is that you get somebody to pre-compute or pre-calculate the decision that you were otherwise going to make in a costly way at the front line, at the edge, yeah. at the border, at the bank counter. You were going to make that decision as an individual with autonomy and some authority. But now it's been pre-computed for you, or cached, or at least arranged in a way that a decision can be generated at the time that you need it by some machine or rule system.
Yeah.
And so now you get to defer to this thing, which actually makes it economically a lot cheaper.
Right.
And even more standardized and more convenient and consistent for the state's convenience, right? That they want everything to be homogeneous and legible. So that's the economy of deference. Both supply and demand exists. The property owners and capitalists and the government bureaucrats and leaders have some benefit to gain from a system that has this economy. But there's also the consumer side and the relying party or the verifier or the bank teller or the border guard who also benefits from this by just offloading this cognitive burden, this ethical dilemma, and just having the system of deference take care of it. And look, if you're a fan of cricket, every cricket match begins with a coin toss to determine who's going to take which side in the game.
Right.
The coin toss is our decision-making deference machine. We just think of this as a trivial enough decision that we don't need a sophisticated way of making that randomized output. But when we want more sophistication in the randomized output, we give it robes and call it a judge. When we want even more sophistication, we generate a GPT and give it prompts. It is just a way of externalizing this thing. But it's not really external, because the source of it is a pre-computation. It's an ahead of time calculation, some loaded dice, if not deterministically, so that it tends to make the decision that's more beneficial to the person that has an interest in it. The trade-off between a deterministic machine that makes the decisions for you and a non-deterministic machine that you can't always guess what's coming up next is that you get plausible deniability. You say, well, you know, my self-driving car doesn't always run over 9-year-olds. It's just in this one instance, it did it, and that's not what it usually does, or it hasn't been seen to be doing that before. So there's some deniability that comes with that. There's also deniability from the diffusion of responsibility, which is we take a large enough data set and you get 10 million people having input into this model, which means you have a firing squad of 10 million people who can all share the responsibility of any bad outcomes that take place, at least from the perspective of the person that owns the model. So the efficiency of these machines increasing, back to the point that Ray was making earlier, if I can just bring that back on the table again, is that by using computation and by conforming people's identities and their documentation in a way that is so perfectly processable.
Right, right.
Where it wasn't so consistent and available symbolically, is that you can enforce this stuff in a granularity that is intrusive and invasive in a way that we're not culturally used to. Although that does change generationally very fast, but up to this point, the idea that you have a real name policy to access a social media platform, even the early social media platforms didn't have that policy, but then they introduced it, but then they couldn't fully enforce it. But now they're beginning to start enforcing it more closely because people are conforming to it.
So interesting. And you have, maybe this is a brief aside, but you have something like the social media age limit in Australia, where how do you prove you are 15 years old or whatever it is? Identity documents come back into it. So I can see, I mean, speaking of Kafka, you know, this, you can never escape this bureaucracy, even though, you know, that social media ban is, as far as we know, well-intentioned. It's just, you know, there's another thing that I really like, this idea of when you design systems, you really need to prioritize the most vulnerable, because the problem is otherwise you construct a system which makes sense for you. But, you know, me as a white man, I have the ideal of, oh, other white men interacting with this system. So I might do things out of a genuine desire to help people that have very nasty consequences for trans folks or for, you know, racialized people or whatever. So,
yeah, this idea of like the identity documents, it's an interesting discussion about how this was like people, the classic thing, classic moral panic is always think of the youth, you know. And we can come on, if we get really bored, we can come on to why Jonathan Haidt and his people are absolutely disgusting and they will never come up with a good policy. But but they're being listened to, even by people on the left, and it's kind of like, it's really tragic in my opinion. But the identity stuff, it turns out that, talking about marginalized people getting hurt, there was a case recently, not recently, the case of OnlyFans recently, where they started to, like, you know, ban pornography or they were worried about not allowing pornography on the platform because certain credit cards would be unhappy about it. Now, it all kind of died down, it died a death. But again, what happens is that there's often a lot of people, and especially trans people, make money on OnlyFans. And those were the people that were most damaged by those changes. So again, like you say, you can end up in a situation where, you know, you think you're doing it for the children, you think you're doing it for like some reason, but it turns out that actually the consequences of that on this kaleidoscopic situation that we have ends up, you know, damaging the most marginalized groups.
I have a great example of this unintended consequence of trying to do something that was meant to be a good idea, because we're still culture developers, I think.
Yes.
So immutability. This is a little anecdote again from the 19th century. So the people that were doing information architecture before we had computers, they think like us. They're people just like us. They think about mutability and immutability semantics of the claims and attributes that they store in a schema about a person, blah, blah, blah. So in revolutionary France, there was a massive panic of distrust of who was who and which side were you on. And this wasn't so much the xenophobic fear of somebody coming from elsewhere. It was just France having a moment by itself. But they were suddenly incentivized to instantiate this massive documentary system of identification cards that acted a bit like passports. And they wanted to make sure they tracked everybody's information in these registers and ledgers. But they realized something that we always realize in software development and information architecture, distributed data systems, because these identity systems are distributed. You have ledgers and certificates and people travel to different places and you have to prove things at different times and so on. They realized immutability is a great design trait. If you can register a person's personal details at the time of their birth and assign them, confer them a name and a sex, and this never changes, then you can maintain integrity in this fundamentally database-like system forever. And you can always tell who's who. If somebody's marked by a name that represents that they're aristocrats, you can always identify them. They don't get to disguise themselves as a commoner just to get away from some vindication or something. So the idea was the elegance of immutability takes precedence over the messiness of human reality, which even in revolutionary France, it was customary for people who had nothing to do with the civil conflict to just use different names at different times and to have multiple names in different contexts and so on.
Sure.
Nothing about that was standardized, especially for common people. So this clashed all of a sudden. You were expected in every government transaction to use your quote-unquote official name.
Yeah.
Luckily for those of us in common law countries, there's no such thing. But certainly in France, there is such a thing. And that was luckily something that disappeared after the revolution. This experiment that showed us so many possibilities of how administrative state can be repressive by accident, in a sense, not in the way that they intended, overriding customs, disallowing people from using their names, and people finding workarounds. They discovered that, oh, you know, when we talk to the government official, we'll use this name, but then when we talk to our neighbors, we'll use the other name, but we just won't let anybody know about that, trying to be secretive about and so on. That example kind of demonstrates this. If you have alienated bureaucrats who are not interacting with the reality of the situation they're trying to model in their information architecture, how detached they can become. And so that's the case today as well. Even now, when I go to a department, like in New Zealand, we have this Department of Internal Affairs, they take care of identity services and documentation and so on. They govern the architecture of how not only the paper documentation works, but the future credentialing system they want with decentralized identity services, blockchain ledger technology. They both, with a paper system, assume that migrants are going to have immutable identity characteristics, so they can record everything in a way that will never change. They have a whole policy about this. And then they, at the same time, are building this new identity system with Web 3.0 technologies, in which I have recently discovered they have not consulted any trans people.
Yep.
So we can favor design characteristics and approaches and engineering qualities that make sense on paper, but you always have to test it against how it works for the people involved. And when you're doing this specific thing of modeling people itself, it doesn't usually map well. This is one of the things, could be a MITS programmers believe about identity blog post or something.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to pick up on something you said. So you push the Web3 button, and I know something that we have pointed to before on this show is that a lot of the Web3 people kind of became the AI people. You know, there's that Venn diagram has a big overlap. And, you know, you were kind of, let's say, gracious there in assuming that, oh, they just forgot to consult trans people, you know, as an oversight, which, you know, who knows, whatever. But there is a very real hostility toward trans folks by at least some of the kind of central figures in this AI push. I mean, Elon Musk is the most obvious example, who has a trans daughter whom he refuses to acknowledge. And she has, in a fit of irony that is so delicious you could stick a fork in it, disowned him. So, but what's going on here? Is Silicon Valley kind of accidentally anti-trans, or is there something else happening here in your opinion?
I don't think it's accidental, but it's difficult to separate Silicon Valley from the state.
You don't say.
So for example, in the Web 2.0 universe, Facebook came along and started to privatize what had up to this point been a monotonically increasing linear growth of the governments around the world taking over identity services. What used to be the domain of the personal and or the domain of the village, and then eventually the domain of the church in certain places to record people's names and baptize them and so on, got monopolized by the state in the guise of justifying regulating movement, which, by the way, was a temporary fix they introduced for the First World War that became permanent, that you had to have paperwork and passports, a familiar pattern for us. But the new development is Facebook showed up and they started to privatize identity provision, something that used to be a function of the state. So then they introduced the 71 genders drop-down box, which seems awfully progressive and friendly, right? But the same company introduced a real names policy, which meant that you had to show your quote-unquote official government ID to even have a name that you could display publicly. And only in some case-by-case situations, I believe the current policy is to allow some exceptions for people who are targets of abuse or can prove that they're of an adequate threshold of transgender. Then they may be allowed to have a different name in some cases. But at the same time, the state is not leaving people like Facebook alone. You've mentioned Australia and the UK. They introduced these age verification systems, which isn't really an age verification system.
Right.
It is a use the government ID system.
Yep.
So this is the revenge of the state, the return of the state. They want to start inserting themselves back as the fundamental identity provider in this chain of trust. They're not happy with private actors taking over that space. So when these systems behave in ways that are transphobic or exclusionary, where is it coming from exactly? Depends. I think it's a dynamic situation. It's like alien versus predator, the state and private organizations, neither of which are friends of trans people, especially. And there's a push and pull going on at the moment.
So do you say AI? I mean, we talked about AI as an automation technology that is accelerating the real harms of the status quo, the actually existing harms. And I know you and I talked, you know, a few weeks ago or something, about has AI fundamentally altered anything for trans folks, or is it an accelerant? So what do you think about that?
I don't want to use the past tense of altered. It's in the process of altering. So there's a process of discovery. We're seeing what's happening as increasing adoption takes place and people start switching over workflows and decision-making that's deferred to the machine now. So, you know, you're probably already familiar with the existing critiques of bias in machine learning.
Sure.
With or without large language models. There's a couple of decades of analysis on that. But if you take the example of, let's say, gender classification on the basis of facial recognition, so you maybe passport photos and then you run a machine learning algorithm over it and it tells you different features that it identifies and maybe tries to classify the person's gender in some way by some inference.
Wait, isn't this just skull measuring again, Retica? It sounds awfully familiar.
Oh, no, this is based on statistics this time, so...
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm
sure it's more rigorous. No, so the classic bias situation in these cases is the training data didn't include ethnic diversity, so suddenly it doesn't know what a male or female is anymore with a different race of person or whatever. But what it does at the end of the day is it produces a classification that does not by itself have much of an effect in the world. It's not necessarily, it's maybe embarrassing, it's maybe a nuisance, it's maybe irritating, but it fits into a data flow that usually involves the rest of the kind of traditional process of whatever identity verification or something is taking place that's used for. And it may cause someone to have, you know, a higher level of security check at an airport because they got misclassified, whatever it might be. But it's not coercive necessarily. It doesn't necessarily affect their life significantly. It's still problematic, but there's something new now. I can best describe this with a Reddit post I came across just a couple of weeks ago, I think, a few weeks ago. There's a subreddit called Women in Tech, where there's a diverse range of opinions about people's experiences in tech, women's experiences in tech, including diverse opinions on AI. Mm-hmm. There was a thread about basically pet peeves and irritations people were experiencing with interacting with these different kinds of AI systems that were being imposed upon them. And one woman in particular commented, and this struck out to me because this is indicative of kind of what could happen more and more. She was, if I can recount correctly, she was in a team with some people in a company who were using Microsoft Teams, and they wanted to update their headshots, profile pictures. And the company had issued them access to some kind of image transformer model whose job was to take an input photograph in its raw form and then come back with some kind of, you know, company aesthetic picture that people could use. So you didn't have to have a graphic designer, or you didn't have to do the graphic design yourself. So in a team mostly full of men, this one cisgender woman who described herself as being a bit punk and having a faded haircut and, you know, a cultural reference t-shirt, this kind of what I would describe as maybe a little bit gender nonconforming, took a picture of her face, submitted to this model with a prompt. And it came back with a transformed version of the picture that she described as lengthening her short hair, rounding her facial features, giving her a blouse. And the word she used was it made her look matronly.
Right. Right.
So conformance to a stereotypical gender traditional role and norm. She also indicated that the men in the team did not have that much alteration to their appearance. You could still make them out as their own individuals. But she specifically experienced this bias. But the bias is not just a classification bias. It's not just a labeling bias. It's specifically a coercive bias. It's prescriptive and says, here's how you ought to look. Now, here's the economic conundrum. She could spend hours going back and forth, prompting this thing again and again to fix the image.
Right. And maybe
it will never do it because its training set doesn't know how to do that.
Or the context window shatters and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And so what she might end up doing, as so many people end up doing, is just saying, this is that one of those workarounds that Ray was mentioning. You know what? It's just a headshot.
Yeah.
I'll use it.
Yeah.
So this is having a coercive effect on people's lives in a way that was not happening so much before.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me about the, I mean, the thing about AI is that, you know, you can get bogged down in the, to some extent you can get bogged down in the technology, but we noticed, we've noticed ourselves, we've talked about this, that at the beginning of the, like the Trump administration, they started to like reduce the amount of diversity, equity, and inclusion as a specific, that was a fairly, you know, sort of milquetoast policy in the first place, but they explicitly wanted to remove it, even by removing anything related to it in terms of government text. And again, you know, this creates a permission structure for other organizations to reduce their efforts to not even reduce their efforts, but they're encouraged to abandon and explicitly reverse their efforts to with DEI. And with the DOGE people, we noticed that they started to use AI. And now with the military stuff, we're seeing AI. And, you know, we don't want, I mean, explicitly, we don't want woke AI. And that means, you know, explicitly that they're kind of judging AI by some standard that essentially says, if it is kind, if it has empathy, then it's wrong. That's how I interpret this kind of like this intervention, if you like, on the way that AI should work. I don't know if that, if maybe it's not you, Josh. Maybe it's Radhika can say something about that.
I was just going to get mad at you for saying if AI has empathy, since it can't have empathy. But I know what you mean, Ray. I know what you mean.
It demonstrates empathy then.
Appears to demonstrate empathy. Anyway.
Produces the illusion of.
Exactly.
Damn it. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I think you've got it, Radhika. Yeah.
Stop anthropomorphizing, Ray. God damn it. And I pronounced it right. Woo.
All right.
So the empathy starts at the beginning of the pipeline.
Right.
It's not that the model demonstrates empathy. It may evidence empathy that was built into some of the factors with which it was designed, the training data that was selected and the tuning that went into it, the reinforcement that went into it, the filtering and the censoring layer and moderation layer and everything that goes into it. I think it's true that a lot of these companies are either outright abandoning those checks and balances, or probably more interestingly to my cynical mind, demonstrating malicious incompetence in implementing them to get us to lose any realistic expectation that they can possibly moderate these kinds of devices. So you see this with Twitter, for example. It'll be used for some terrible objectionable purpose. They'll make a fig leaf gesture at trying to fix it, but next week it's still happening. Eventually we just give up on ever moderating these things. And so then that gives the deployment of these models an increasing status of autonomy in relationship to society. Whether you're a booster or a doomer, what you want to do is enhance the view that these things are autonomous forces of nature that can act as these sources of deference that you can appeal to resolve ethical dilemmas and questions. And of course, they are random number generators effectively for the decisions, but they are loaded dice, biased towards some particular favorable outcome for the people that are producing them. So yeah, who is loading the dice? Are they transphobic? Do they want these machines to, you know, one of my fears is, and I'm sure this is happening already, but you know, I don't want to speculate too much. It's the sort of thing I'm afraid there'll be evidence of and reporting about as time goes on. Kids who are in a state of, oh, I can do this too. Think of the children. Kids who are...
I'm getting ready to panic morally, Radhika. You go for it.
Kids who are exploring their gender, they're questioning perhaps. They may or may not be transgender. They might figure out they're not transgender. Most people are not transgender. But some kids who are vulnerable and kind of figuring this out, turning to a chatbot and using that as a kind of therapist, depending on whether it's Grok or some other place for the moment, they may get very different responses and advice. And that's a very vulnerable situation in which to have to be exposed to that risk, where they also are not in a place where they can make a judgment about how reliable these sources of information are. I mean, even as I say it, I'm panicking slightly at the thought of it. I want to throw a bone out there for the people who will no doubt say, I think you've covered this subject in a previous podcast as well. It's not all bad. It depends on some of the applications, how it might help. So just to give some counterweight to the, you know, what if kids use a chatbot as a therapist? That's a hypothetical question, right? Which I deeply believe is probably happening as it is, and the outcomes of which we'll measure later. But something we can be sure about is there are some applications of this technology which are beneficial to trans people, especially trans kids, surprisingly. And there are some potential applications which I'm also hopeful about in the future. So this might temper the question of resistance a little bit, or might motivate us further, it depends. One application that comes to mind is your classic novelty gender swap face filter on camera apps. For most people, you use this app as a fun thing, use the gender swap thing on your partner and you laugh about it, post it online on TikTok, it's funny. But for a very small minority of people who are actually, you know, experimenting with the idea of maybe they're transgender, again, they're questioning, they may or may not be transgender, but they might be exploring it. They can use this device to imagine, visually represent how they might look differently. And that can be an indication. It's not a definitive test by any means, but it's an indication of the journey of someone who's exploring their identity to get a sense of how they feel about it. You know, most straightforwardly, again, this is not definitive, so I don't want anybody to feel like, oh, I did the gender swap thing and I'm not sure if I'm trans or not or whatever. but if some people might feel like when they see their image reflected in a way that matches their internal self-identity, when it's realized in front of them, it can give them relief from gender dysphoria, which is these disturbing feelings that don't feel like your gender identity aligns with your physical representation. Or it might feel like gender euphoria, where you actually feel kind of slightly surprised and delighted by what you're seeing on the screen. All of a sudden, it reflects you, it feels authentic. Even though this is a construction by some machine learning model that's doing real-time transformations to frames of a video. Now that practice, I'll give away my age a little bit here. When I was growing up, I don't know if you...
Back in the 19th century, right? Because you keep going back to that.
As Uncle Albert would say in Only Fools and Horses, during the war. just that reference dates me. So half your listeners won't recognize it. When I was younger and going through this formative period of exploring my gender identity and things like that, I would have to do what people did for centuries beforehand. That was the technology at the time, which is if I want to explore a different appearance and shape of my body and things, I would have to go to a drag bar and kind of dip my toe in the water by perhaps being in that environment. Or the other activity people did is quote unquote cross-dressing. And a lot of trans people throughout history are often mislabeled in records as cross-dressers or transvestites, because that was the way in which you could compartmentalize parts of your life and be able to exist when the rest of your life was oppressive and didn't allow you space to do that. So that's how I would have to gain access to this exploration, but I didn't have the privacy to really engage with it. So I was kind of stuck not having space and time to do it. But I had access to Web 1.0, which wasn't called Web 1.0 at the time, just like the First World War wasn't the First World War. It was the Great War to end all wars. There wasn't supposed to be anything else after it.
Right.
It all went bad afterwards. So in Web 1.0, the definition of it is that there were a small number of people online with a large number of places to go to.
Yeah, and we had Alta Vista, so, you know,
yeah,
we could find those places sometimes.
Yeah, or you could just enumerate usernames of GeoCities.
Yes.
And Web 2.0, by contrast, is a large number of people come online, but they have a small number of places to go to because of platformization and consolidation.
Yeah.
In the Web 1.0 world, so if you think of that topology, in the Web 1.0 world, I could go to this website and express myself with maybe, because it's with my school friends or something, on a forum, I could express myself with the identity they know me as. I could stay in the closet. But I could go to a different website and I could express myself with a different persona and identity that can adopt just there. Or even outside the web, I could go to an IRC chat and I could adopt a handle and nickname that indicates a different kind of gender expression and be seen and interact with people in the way that I would prefer. In a consolidated universe of Facebook regulating your centralized identity, you can't do that compartmentalization anymore.
And guess what? Anytime you have to pay for something, well, that's tied to a credit card, which has a government ID on it. So there's no way to be anonymous anymore.
And the young people today, as I understand it, use Discord, which in Australia now you have to have age verification, which means the real IDs. And they don't have a real names policy yet, but that could follow. That's the next logical step. So again, with that strict enforcement and consistent enforcement at the boundaries, not just space for workarounds, but also space for exploration or play is lost. And for people in a formative stage, that's vital. And without that, access is hard. So what I did in Web 1.0 is, besides going to different places with different identities to kind of figure out myself, I also had access to graphics packages. So I could get a graphics editor up, take a low resolution picture of my face and pixel edit my face in a way that would make me look like I was gender swapped the way these filters would do. So kids these days don't know how good they have it. It's so easy. I used to handcraft pixel by pixel.
Oh, back in my day.
Yeah,
one frame.
Yeah.
But they have a live stream of video. So this is the thing that gives them a lot more privacy. They can go sit in a corner of a room and without anybody locally invading their privacy, they can see the reflected image on the phone, which can be a part of this exploratory journey. It's harmless. It's just something that adds to the picture. But then their privacy is invaded on the device, right? Like it depends who the provider is and where the images are going and everything else. So the scope of privacy is different.
Yeah. Radhika, maybe... I'll jump in here for a second, because one of the things that we are doing in the season is actually exploring the question of, so Ray came up with this idea of hellish AI, which we mentioned on episode one of the season, where we kind of try to enumerate like what our critique of AI really boils down to. And then we have this other thing, heavenly AI, which is kind of a question mark, right? Like, can such a thing exist? And the example you just laid out, I think this is a really interesting one to spend, you know, a couple of minutes on. So one of the things that in the Stochastic Parrots paper, Temnit Gebru and Emily Bender and the other authors of that paper, one of the things they point to is that in order for a model to be made safe, for however you want to define safe, it needs to be narrow and it needs to have high quality training data. So I could look at the application you just put out as something that could be useful to a young person exploring their gender identity. And it's like, why not? Right. But I think there's some prerequisites we have to throw there. First of all, that model needs to be developed only for that, because then we can actually test for these kind of negative consequences. Also, to go back to what you said, let's consult some trans people. You know, let's actually have computer scientists or experts in machine learning who are themselves trans actually intimately involved with the creation of these models. So I kind of want to, you know, like at the risk of, I don't want to let people think that what we're saying is that LLMs are incredibly harmful, but they might do this one good thing. It's like, yeah, like machine learning, you know, computer vision has a lot of really nasty applications. Like they're all about surveillance and murder. But people always point to that one potentially useful property of computer vision, detecting tumors. Yay. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any proof that this has actually happened. And in fact, I think we've seen statistics about the usual human in the loop thing, you know, where actually they can lead to worse outcomes, but blah, blah, blah. But I guess the point I'm making in a very roundabout and long-winded way, apologies to audience members who are used to that from me, but I'm not precluding that we could use aspects of this technology. I don't care if it's a transformer model or some other machine learning, but like, I totally accept, yes, there could be genuinely useful, valuable applications of this stuff. But what I'm contesting is the Uber model, right? The model that does all things, the multimodal model, basically. Okay, I'm stopping. If anybody has reactions to that, go ahead. Otherwise, move on to your second point, Radhik.
No, I have a reaction to that. You're picking up on an important thing about the packaging of this set of concepts. I think you've just disaggregated this before in your podcast, this notion of AI is not one thing and so on. But my angle on that is it reminds me of another time in history, but we're not going to the 19th century this time.
I was ready.
We're going back about 18 years to the global financial crisis, which, if you recall, was fueled by toxic assets that were called CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. So how these instruments worked is that they took subprime mortgages, which are no good debt, people were going to default in it, but they bundled them up with other good stuff to make the value of the collective asset seem a bit more valuable.
Tranches, Radhika, they were called tranches. Tranches.
And so they went out, transported into the market, and everybody bought them, and we had this problem. I keep thinking of AI as this thing that just reminds me of this collateralized debt obligation. This is massive thing that does have elements in it, that some of which are quite familiar technologies, that go back about a generation or two. With the narrow focused machine learning, when we had fewer compute resources, you had to build this kind of like Apollo program of software with machine
endless
learning.
Endless data as well.
Right, mm-hmm. Endless data as well, the corpuses and everything else. So I'm a big fan of some of these very narrow focused accessibility tools, optical mm-hmm. character recognition, speech synthesis, and so on. And the very fact that they're focused exactly as the authors you mentioned point out does make it useful. And I can see the example I gave you, for instance, of this face filter thing. If it was, the way it's used at the moment is by accident. It's a novelty mm-hmm. app. And just mm-hmm. by chance, some creative yep. trans kids have figured out yep. how to use this thing for their own benefit. That's not why it was put out in the world, right?
No.
And you can almost expect that if someone discovered this was benefiting trans people, they'd withdraw it or retract it or restrict it or something.
Yes.
And that's not a way for people to exist, right? So if we did mm-hmm. the approach that you were describing, which is beyond just the machine learning model being narrow and safe, having a designed software package that helps kids learn about themselves, explore, that isn't necessarily leading them to a particular conclusion, but lets them, you know, safely with privacy have these features, That would be amazing. I mean, mind-blowing, right? Like, why has no software developer done this? Because some of us are too busy trying to update our documentation. You think of the resource thing.
Let the AI do that, please. Come on.
So, yeah, I think I'm not making the argument either that there's this redeeming silver lining. Mm. And I don't think any of that is happening in a way that's intentional to make the world a better place either.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It just shows the potential, right? So I have this hope personally, like long before this podcast, again, going back to about the time of the global financial crisis, actually, I launched a podcast at the time. You may not remember this. I don't know if you're paying attention at the time in the Lisp universe. I launched a podcast called The Weekly REPL, which is an effort to kind of give news and updates and community interviews and things about Common Lisp at the time that Clojure was still being born. I did it for 6 episodes and then I stopped. Well, 5 episodes. I did a 6th one. I didn't publish it and I stopped because I was getting feedback about that podcast that people were saying they're really enjoying my voice. They like my voice, apparently. I have a voice for radio, they said, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
I hated this feedback because I was feeling dysphoric about my voice.
Interesting.
For me, that felt like it was addressing a masculine attribute that I could not change. It was a product of a testosterone-based puberty that I didn't like. I even did vocal coaching and things in years since. And I think I'm the first and only person to have failed vocal coaching. I can't seem to adjust my voice. I speak in one way and I can't change it. So now I just live with it with a sense of dissonance all the time.
Hmm.
For practical purposes, I have to use my voice. But if somebody told me they could use this speech synthesis machine learning algorithm and make a biomedical prosthetic or something that could transform my voice in some way, I would be interested, right? That's an application I want to see. That's not an application the market is going to deliver, but I would love to have a device like that.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of potential there for sure. With the right constraints and guardrails, there are specific applications I can imagine. And a lot of them will help trans people who are in situations similar to mine in this particular case.
Hmm.
It's kind of a tragedy in a sense because I'm not focusing on the generative component or the large language model component, but just in this collateralized debt obligation of what we call AI, some of the elements of it, which go back about, again, 20 years or so of research, we could be doing great things with them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just have to throw some Empire of AI out, right? One of the points, Karen, how the author of that book makes is that generative AI, large language models, are sucking all of the research funding out of these other, you know, good tranches, the high quality tranches of the CDO that is AI. They're just sucking that out of the room. And the only thing getting funded is, you know, the transformer architecture research, et cetera.
There are plenty of bits of technology that in and of themselves could be handy for all sorts of people. And there's no doubt about that. The thing for us about the current manifestation of the technology is the surveillance kind of nature of it, the mass nature of it, the overwhelmingly hegemonic nature of it. And that's the problem, is that you end up, what we want to avoid is end up arguing about individual applications of technology, because, you know, you can always, you know, think of the children, you know, exactly as you said yourself, you know, you can always think of the trans children or the other children, whatever children you can think of, they're always there to be kind of used in as a sort of human shield for whatever you want to promote or whatever you want to destroy. So that's the problem for me, is that, you know, I don't want to get kind of like in the weeds or in a sort of like mud fight about a specific potentially harmful use of this technology, because I feel like the individual threads of this technology, you can say, oh, it's a double-edged sword, you know, it's a classic argument. Oh, you know, well, it's got some good parts, it's got some bad parts. No, I refute that. In its current manifestation, it is all bad. And I really just want to be really firm on that. So that's where I'm going to leave that part of the conversation.
So we have been talking for a while now.
Yes.
And
yes, we have.
Radhika, I'm going to put you in a spot that I know is not your favorite spot, given your reluctance. But as you mentioned, most people are not trans, and I assume most of the listeners to this episode will not be trans people. I'm hoping if they're listening to this podcast, what you've shared has resonated with them, and I hope that they are ready to stand in solidarity with trans people, whether they are known or unknown to audience members. So I'm wondering, are there things, Ray and I are cis men, I assume, again, the majority of our audience will be cis people. What can we do, if anything, to stand in solidarity with trans folks in resistance to the harms of AI that you've described in this episode and that we have talked about previously?
So the reason I'm reluctant to answer a question like this is because who am I addressing, even if you say people like yourselves? There's still, it's not just a diversity of identities, diversity of different circumstances, ability, capability, resources, and so on. It's very hard for me to say something that won't alienate somebody in the process. What I would say is my expectation, my philosophy, I will also rescue something from the Enlightenment. I'm a Lockean individualist, which is why I'm such a big fan of the common law idea of name changes and so on that are self-determined. My call to people is figure out what you can do, but the work program is, like the agenda is, looking a lot like the shape of the problem we discussed just now. Before we try to fix how AI is affecting trans people, the important thing to understand is that there are unresolved problems in the prior generations of information architecture that we've had imposed on us with this administrative state that rose about 100 years ago, beginning with passports, driver's licenses, these kinds of things. Fixing those issues while we still have those systems as current is good, but also heading off the translation of those same problems into the new generation of technologies. So we have the Web 3.0 stuff with micro-credentials, distributed identity, and so on, that is prone to reproducing the same issues and maybe even causing us to feel like, well, these technologies, you have distributed information and updating them is difficult, right? So we should do the French revolutionary thing and treat everything as immutable. That's a temptation. The same temptation comes up with the large language models in particular, where you might get a corpus of data that includes identity information. Government departments like the one I'm dealing with, they're looking at taking their citizenship records and putting that into large language models for the sake of government internal services and processing. But once you encode that information into the model, as we've seen with cases of like copyrighted works and so on, tracking and tracing the information and updating it and doing life cycle changes on is hard. So, okay, so we treat it as immutable because once it's in the model and you can't touch it. You can try to do probabilistic reinforcement learning on it and corrections on it, but that's not going to be 100% applicable. Sometimes you'll talk to the model and it'll identify you by one name. Sometimes the same model will identify you by a different name. But that came from a place where we did not have an enlightened view, so to speak, of people's identity in the first place. And wherever you can contribute to any of these things would be good, I think. If I can speak specifically to people who are functional programmers and Clojure developers, immutability is a good thing in some contexts. It's not necessarily applicable to humans, right? And that principle applies to anybody who's building systems, I guess. There are economies we can gain by doing pre-computation ahead of time, but locking us into a snapshot of a human view at a certain point in time and saying that can never change, that's not a good thing either. So if you're the kind of person who's developing systems or contributing to them, even if you're vibe coding a website in a weekend, are you sure that the generated website is going to handle accessibility properly? Are you sure it's going to handle transgender people signing up with a name field or a preferred name field properly and so on? Can they update their name once they've registered, or is that basically treated as an immutable record? Can they change their email address? This kind of thing. Those decisions can be accidental at the best of times with humans intervening, but when you automate that to a machine with the deference that you give it, it makes the ethically difficult decision of deciding, well, these people don't deserve access to the system.
Which it is going to do, you know, because the majority of systems do not handle these things well. And so LLMs tend to, you know, they do tend to surface the kind of common case.
Immutability is like the ancient stones, the ancient ledgers, the ancient kind of counts of things. It didn't mean that things couldn't increase or that the amount of stock that you had couldn't change. It just meant that you knew at a certain point in time what that stock level was. You could look back at it. You could look back at the books and say, actually, the profit last year was £1,000 and now it's £2,000. It's immutable, but the thing that's true now is not the immutable thing anymore. And I think that's the important point about immutability, is that immutability, it acts as a kind of audit trail, but not as a source of truth. Not a source of truth at a particular point in time, but not a source of truth of reality.
But not even that, Ray, because I'll do you one better. I think you're on. What you said is we have an audit trail of a snapshot of the truth at that point in time. I would say that what we have is an audit trail of the facts that were known to the system at that time.
Yes, that's a better way of saying it. Yeah.
And those facts, I mean, to your point, Radhika, like we could have written down someone's gender as F at some point in the past, right? Would that person have said their gender was F at that point in time? Like, you know, did we ask them? But some government DB has an F at that point in time. So what does that mean? It just means that the state considered that person's gender F. By the way, F doesn't have to mean female. I could have used any letter, right? I could have used H, whatever that is.
H is Dutch for men, heren. But okay, oh, carry on.
Sorry. Z, there you go. I'm sure it means something in some language. I guess the problem you're getting at, Radhika, is that they want to make identity itself immutable and not let the values of that identity vary over time.
I'm actually also meaning everything that both of you have just said as problematizing it. Because, for example, when we say someone historically had this assigned identity, maybe at the time of birth, you were given a name and you were given a sex marker, you were also perhaps measured for height and weight as a baby.
Right, yes.
Is that your height for your lifetime? Is that your weight for your lifetime? Well, hopefully you have a long enough lifetime that it will change.
Yes.
So why should the gender marker be of interest what it was when you were a baby?
Yeah.
So that the audit trail problem, I can give you a practical example of what happens in New Zealand. If you're a person born in the country, lived in the country, grew up in the country, and a citizen of the country, you have a right created in legislation to amend your birth certificate and birth record. That's the database and the document. When you amend it by saying, I have a new preferred nominated name and sex marker, the previous information is kept on file, but it's given private authority. So nobody else can see it except for certain limited purposes for government identity matching and information matching purposes and security purposes. But largely it becomes deprecated and becomes hidden.
Hmm.
So you get a right to privacy over whether you're a trans person or not. So if you're somebody who quote unquote passes in society, you don't necessarily want to disclose to everybody you meet, hey, by the way, I'm transgender, right?
Right, right. Yeah, of course.
You might be able to avoid certain discrimination if that history wasn't revealed. But if you're like me and you're a person who became a citizen of the country by naturalization, the paperwork that you've got as the origin document in the country is a citizenship certificate and a citizenship record, which is a parallel to the birth information.
Right.
But I can't get rid of the historical information that's what they call a point-in-time record. The bureaucrats were not software developers. They also use this phrase. They say it's a point-in-time record. It just records a fact that was true at the time. And they also say, by the way, when you register for citizenship, you said this was your name.
Right.
You declared this. Now, the reason I said that is because I could only use a name that matched my passport that came from India, which I can't change. I was coerced into saying that name because I had no other choice.
Right.
I now want to retrospectively update it, but they say because it's a point-in-time record, just a fact that was true at the time, what we have is an append-only semantics. We can give you an additional sheet of paper that says, oh, later you changed your mind. So now when you go to a potential employer, you can say, well, I'm known as this name, and here's my citizenship proof to show I'm eligible to work in this jurisdiction, this market. But by the way, here's my entire gender history for you to peruse. I should not have to disclose that private information. I would genuinely prefer a destructive update like it's C++. Like I want to obliterate the previous information because I had no say in that. Somebody else decided it. I don't relate to that information. It has no bearing on me as anything I want to present to somebody else. Now, people will vary on this. Different trans people have different opinions on this.
Sure.
But for me, at least what I want to see is parity. If you're a person who's an in-group of the nation state and you are given this right with your birth information, I should have the same right with my citizenship information, right? At the very least.
Right.
I would contest this. This is the way humans are messy, right? We have privacy requirements that are not something that you care about for data structures and memory, so you can do structural sharing. And the fact that something is derived from a previous piece of information is okay. You can build a lens over it and you can collapse it and compute it and whatnot. But if I have to go to an employer or make a visa application in another country and give them a stack of documents that they have to traverse through to work out what is your current name and gender actually? And by the way, that documentation that they add, the extra sheet of paper, doesn't have any legal weight. So that if I'm applying for a visa, the other country can say, well, I'm going to stick to the original record. I'm not going to stick to this advisory information, this hint about a change that you preferred to make. And so then I'll get the wrong name because that's been revealed to this party that should not even have to know that information.
Right.
Privacy law could be improved on this, but this is the other thing about common law. In common law, you just get to do what you want, basically. You can have a name and use it, and that's your legal name, and congratulations. Your previous name doesn't have to follow you around in a paper trail.
I think the idea about you choosing which version of the data you supply, as long as it, like you say, if the difference what you're saying here is that in the first case, the second version is equally as valid as the first version, but in your case, the second version isn't. And that's the problem, essentially.
It's also the disclosure of the first version. Nobody has to know.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I mean. Yeah. So the second one supersedes it and affords these extra privacy rights. And in your case, the second case, it's just an advisory over the first case. So it's a completely different set of behaviors, I would say.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, I don't want to argue about immutability on this podcast. Jesus Christ. You know.
So many people I meet who are transgender are in IT, software development, computer science, right? And I can't help but reflect on the fact that the two hardest problems in computer science, naming things and invalidating caches, which is my life most of the time. I think you need to be a computer scientist to survive as a trans person sometimes. Can't help but bring up immutability.
I think that's a killer ending, actually.
Well, but I want to make a more prosaic ending, because you did ask the serious question about how people can help. And I should put into context everything we discussed in this podcast. I focused in on this question of epistemic violence and epistemic justice and epistemic self-defense, which is all about this plane of knowledge, information architecture, identification details, and so on. But trans people's lives are so much more than identifying papers. I had this interesting discussion with a company recently that I wanted to update my information to have my preferred name, my common law name. And they said, oh, it must match your photo ID. Otherwise, we can't change your name. But I don't have photo ID in the new name. But also, if I had photo ID in the new name, it wouldn't match the old records. How would they know I'm the right person to update it? I could be taking over the account. And if I had photo ID in the old name, I couldn't give them a new name in the first place. This whole policy doesn't make any sense. But they sent me this thing that I'm fairly sure is generated by ChatGPT's legal screed. And this is something I come across as an activist some of the time. I don't know who I'm talking to anymore. I may be getting a response from something generated from a chatbot. This kind of legalese that was preposterous. It made claims like, to have a contract, you must have verified photo ID. Otherwise, you can't be a signatory to the contract. Otherwise, there's a risk of fraud. So I responded to them eventually with a citation that 8,000 years ago on stone tablets, when the first contracts were drawn up, they did name people and they didn't have photo ID. And so we have about 8,000 years of precedent for no photo ID and about 80 years of precedent for photo ID. This kind of expectation people have, it does affect trans people. It does make a practical difference, but there's other spheres in which trans people intersect with technology. And I focused in on the stuff that is interesting to your podcast because of the AI theme and tried to bring it into that. But we could have talked about politics and technology of transgender medicine, which is not a topic I want to touch because I'm not expert in it. I will say on a public policy perspective, I disagree with people who believe you should gatekeep being transgender as you need to have this many medical interventions to qualify. That's something governments also do. But as soon as I say you don't need to have transgender medical interventions to qualify as a trans person, because just like with the contracts, trans people existed as long as gender has been around. We've not had transgender medicine in the same advanced state all this time. People say, oh, so you're saying that transgender medicine is surplus to requirements, so we should pull the funding for research and development and healthcare delivery and everything else. So my position is that it should be a right, but not a mandate and not a prohibition at the same time. And the other topic of transgender medicine is people are using AI-like systems for trans healthcare like every other field of healthcare. Yeah. And somebody else, I'm sure, can talk about that. But if you're someone looking to contribute and help, maybe that's interesting to you. Maybe there's something you can help with, not the epistemic question of information architecture and documentation, paperwork and everything, which I'm specializing in. There's economic justice. We talked briefly about trans people in sex work online, but trans people are also overrepresented in gig work, in the precariat, in that kind of economy where the reverse centaur is now dominating gradually. And real name policies for these kinds of gig work platforms as well are causing trans people to have to be outed wherever those policies apply. Somebody could talk about distributive justice and economic justice and this kind of thing. Maybe I'm not the best person to talk about that because I speak about this specific topic, right? So again, if you're someone looking to help, there's actually a wide range of issues. If you do a cybersecurity threat model kind of thing on a trans life, like where's all the trouble coming from? It's 360 degrees. It's everywhere. So I've narrowed down this particular topic, but I don't want people to get the impression this is the only thing that matters or is the only thing you can help with. It's representative of some of those fault lines and divisions, those structures and hierarchies we talked about with the racial contract and intersections with migrants and so on. I'm hoping that's illustrative and inspiring to people who feel like, well, I get a sense that there's complicated things like this going on. Maybe somebody can help. But I don't know who's listening, and I don't know what they're capable of, and I don't know what resources they have, and which of these areas are going to be interesting to them. So I just want to lay that out as options on the table.
Yeah.
Great.
I think there are some really good options, Radhika, and I feel confident that there will be people in our audience who have at least some of those skills and experiences. And hopefully after this conversation, more knowledge about what they're up against, basically. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, experience, and knowledge with us tonight for us, or early in the morning for you. Really appreciate it, and always good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks very much for all the 19th century stuff as well. It was great.
We went back to the Neolithic Revolution.
That we did. 8,000 years. I was there, Gandalf, 8,000 years ago. Speaking of New Zealand.
Thanks for having me. This has been a great chat.
That was a pleasure. Thank you very much. This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!